The following radio program is for informational purposes only and is neither specific nor tailored financial advice to any individual. It is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Always do your own due diligence and consult a financial advisor before making any investments. Investing involves risk, which can result in the loss of any or all principal. Peter Weitz is a registered investment advisor with Fusion Analytics Investment Partners, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, as well as a registered rep with Fusion Analytics Securities, LLC, a FINRA-registered broker-dealer and SIPC member. All views expressed in this program are those of the host or guests and do not reflect the opinions of Fusion Analytics Investment Partners nor its affiliates. Your investments. How secure are you that they are secure? Do you want to know more about investing, retirement, and moving to the next level in business? Welcome to In Black and Whites, featuring host Peter Weitz. Our program will answer all of the questions about your future and so much more. It's all about smart business and smarter investing. Now, here is your host, Peter Weitz.
Hi, thanks. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Peter Weitz. Thanks to Kevin Lane last week, we were able to comment on the geopolitical forces in the world and the impact it had here in the United States with regards to the financial markets. And this week I had lined up a great guest. We were going to talk about some interesting growth of what I think is a very diverse industry. And I just want to comment on it before I get started by saying sometimes it's better to be lucky than it is to be good. And because as I mentioned to you today, I'm joined by a sommelier and a certified specialist of wine and spirits from the Society of Wine Engineers, Mark Schlossberg. But the timing of it is amazing in light of what just happened in Napa Valley over the weekend. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that earthquake means to the wine industry for at least the next foreseeable couple of years. But Mark, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And it's, so as I mentioned, Mark is a sommelier. Mark's also a professor of wine. He teaches wine tasting as a craft. And so we're fortunate enough to have his expertise today. But, you know, Mark, all of a sudden we talk about the wine industry, and I want to kind of just take a little bit of time talking about the earthquake in Napa and really what kind of – I mean, we might not be able to measure in dollars yet what the impact is going to be. But, you know, when you see these big oak barrels falling over and grapes and wine that's been fermenting pours out, I mean, what goes through your mind?
Well, first I start to cry. But the other thing is that, at least for this year's vintage, most of it hasn't been harvested yet. The grapes are still on the vine, you know, out in the field, so it's in the vineyards. They really haven't been that affected by it as far as this year's vintage goes. And then it just becomes how, where the wine was stored and where they were, at the time of the earthquake and how that's just dealt with. You know, the news likes to show a lot of barrel smashing because it makes good headlines. It doesn't mean yet that there's been a lot of impact. Of course, when they look at structural damage, you know, as they go through that with the potential wineries and how that affects them, that could be different, but they haven't been able to do all of that yet.
So the wines that potentially were impacted could have been, you know, a couple of years or could, you know, have been picked a couple of years ago and just have been aging. I mean, were those vintages for the last couple of years supposed to have been, you know, stellar vintages?
Oh, some of them were excellent. And it's, you know, they're aging in caves, and those caves may oftentimes have been there for a very long time and are able to withstand these sorts of these things. But that kind of impact, that won't be known for a while yet till they can see, measure the structural damage to the wineries and see if how they have access to those sorts of things.
And so really it might be much ado about nothing.
Exactly.
Interesting.
But it makes for a nice story.
No, yeah, well, it does. And it also serves as a great timely introduction to having you on today's program. But you and I have talked at length about wine, and I kind of want to just, you know, if you – like, how big really is this industry?
Well, wine grapes are the number one agricultural crop in the world.
And they've been that way for how long?
6,000 years, I mean – Right. Grapes are the only fruit that can ferment themselves. Wine is made naturally. It happens whether man intervenes or not. And for centuries, possibly even millennia, it replaced water as a safe beverage because before people understood sanitation, wine was one of the only safe things to drink.
Yeah, so we're dealing with essentially, you know, 6,000 years of a product.
Absolutely, even possibly even longer. It's maybe even up to 7,000. I mean, there's they find fossilized remnants of wine in ancient Persia. You know, what's now modern day Iran. You know, 6-7 millennia old. When they unearthed King Tut's tomb, he was buried with not only jars of wine, but each of the jars were inscribed with the vintage year, the winemaker's name, and winemaker's comments on the wine.
And they're still fine. Are any of those still in existence today?
The fossilized remnants are not beverage that's drinkable.
Right. So, you know, I obviously setting the stage for this industry. I mean, it's enormous, but you know, I find that it's changing almost on a regular and daily basis. You know, today there's big talk about millennials getting more involved in wine drinking. You know, I guess when I was growing up and, you know, I was, you know, of the age to drink and 21, drinking wine was not cool at all. You know, back then it was more Bartles and James than anything else.
Yeah, well, things go in cycles. You know, nobody wants to do what their parents did, and everything that's old is new again. Now we have these classic and craft cocktails. But in the 50s with the beatniks, they wanted to go to coffee houses and drink wine and listen to the poetry because their parents all drank those classic cocktails. And now we're coming around, you know, everything that's old is new again. Everybody's drinking pre-prohibition-style cocktails again. And that's just kind of that's sort of the thing. Every generation likes to think they invented it. It doesn't matter what it is. It's every generation thinks they're the first one who thinks of it.
Yeah, and I we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about how you analyze a wine. But, you know, let's walk through just basically. I mean, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, the land in Napa being expensive and so forth. But, you know, what really justifies a wine costing $10 versus $100?
Well, there are many, many things. Part of it is the cost of production. Part of it is the prestige value of the wine, and also the perceived value of the wine and sort of supply and demand. I mean, like, if you're talking about grapes that come from a famous vineyard in Napa, like the Beckstoff or Tokalon vineyard, which are the most expensive Cabernet grapes in Napa Valley, obviously that's going to necessitate a much higher selling price and a much greater prestige and a greater value for that product than wine that's grown in a much lesser location. Kind of like real estate, you know, your zip code really matters. So that affects the price. Another part of it might be just the fame or the value of the winemaker or the people making the wine. If you're hiring a world-renowned winemaker, they're going to carry a big fee. Again, that goes into the cost of production. Part of it's also the scarcity or the rarity of it. It's like if you talk about Burgundies and some of the fine Burgundies of France, you know, like DRC, Domaine de la Romanée Conti, probably the most famous Pinot Noir vineyard in the world, is only about 4.7 acres. And everybody who can afford it in the world is trying to get it, so that drives the price up.
Yeah, that's amazing, 4.7. So what can they produce on a 4.7-acre plot?
They produce as much as they can. but with the quality and the heritage of the wine is way more important to them typically than the overproduction of quantity. And these are wines that wholesale at thousands of dollars for a regular, you know, five glasses of wine in a bottle sort of bottle.
Yeah, and how important is the label? Is it just marketing?
Well, if you're talking about the label, meaning the information on the label, that's very important. If you're talking about the look of it, it's only as important as packaging is to any marketing strategy.
Right.
You know, if it's something that's going to be on a retail shelf, then obviously the producer wants, and certainly their marketing team wants, something that's going to leap off the shelf into the grocery cart. But if it's something that's sold as a prestige wine, then the label and the packaging should reflect, you know, the expense and the prestige of the product inside.
All right, so let me just digress for a moment. So, I mean, how did you get involved in wine in the first place?
I was a waiter in college, and I wanted to earn more money. And it was very easy for me to figure out that four people out to dinner weren't going to order more than four dinners. But if I was able to sell them wine, and the more I knew about wine, the easier it would be to sell, then I would dramatically be able to improve my income.
And where did you begin? I mean, presumably the internet wasn't as robust as it is today.
Yes, that's quite accurate. I started learning about the wines that we were selling in the restaurant where I worked and reading wine publications and, you know, tasting wine. It's amazing what you can learn from tasting wine. I don't mean drinking wine, which is, of course, fun. I mean tasting it critically to learn the differences between this grape and that grape, or the difference that affects the flavor of the wine and the texture of the wine from this climate to that climate. And then also being able to understand how it pairs with the food or the experience to make the whole greater than the sum of the parts. And that's usually the most effective way to sell it. And then, of course, adding a little bit of romance and a bit of a story behind it that, you know, helps sell the wine as well, some history, that sort of thing. And that's kind of how I started.
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost thinking you got to be a cross between a master in geography and a chemist to really understand good wine.
If you want to go that far, it certainly helps. But understanding what it tastes like and what you like and being able to explain that goes so far to getting you there that only people like me really need to start studying that other stuff.
Right. And because, I mean, when I taste a wine, I don't taste what you taste. But that doesn't mean that I can't. It's just I don't have the experience.
Well, when I used to teach at a culinary college, and what I used to tell my students was, you know, nobody runs a marathon the first day they go for a jog. You know, you got to build up to that. And it's not physically a muscle, but we refer to it as that. You know, you got to develop that muscle. There's more than 10,000 different aromas that the human brain can identify, but we can only train our brains to identify about 1,000 of them. And if you use, as a sommelier would use, a simple set of deductive steps to break it down, to snatch out of thin air the one particular aroma out of those many thousands is very difficult unless it's a very pronounced aroma. I mean, everybody knows what a rotten egg smells like. Almost everybody knows what garlic smells like. But to understand the subtle nuances of the difference between the smell of jasmine and the smell of violets, not everybody's there.
So yeah, I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
Well, first you have to learn what they smell like. But the other thing is it's sort of a, when you look at all of the aromas, you say, oh, do I smell fruit? Okay, if you say I smell fruit, there's probably only about 1,200 or 1,500 fruit aromas out of those 10 or 12,000 aromas. So you've cut out more than 90% of the possible aromas by just saying I smell fruit. Then if you can look at it and say, well, do I smell tropical fruit or citrus fruit or berry fruit, then you've cut that down from, you know, 1,000 to only a few hundred. And then as you go through that, in two or three steps, you've cut thousands and thousands of aromas down to a possible couple dozen that you're really trying to identify. And then if you look at that as a category, then you can say, well, I like these flavors. What wines have these flavors? And then you can seek out wines that fall into that category and help your enjoyment.
And so presumably I can find these flavors or the things I should be thinking about somewhere? Or is there a publication that just says these are potential aromas?
Well, you could read up on it, or you could utilize, you know, the clerk at the local wine shop, or read the, you know, the labels. Oftentimes now, especially with the larger wine companies, they'll tell you on the label, this wine has these flavors, or this wine would pair well with this kind of food, and that sort of thing. So then you can kind of go with that. But it's also part of the fun of learning. If you say, wow, I like wines with a blackberry flavor, okay, well, there are a few different wines that might have that. Cabernet might have it. Zinfandel might have it. Malbec might have it. Oh, I've never had a Malbec. Well, I like other wines with that flavor. Maybe I should try this. And then you learn about wines from another place. And then it helps you expand it without taking too great a risk. Then when you say, oh, maybe I do like Malbec. Well, where is that grown? Oh, it's grown in Argentina. Well, what other wines do they grow in Argentina? Maybe I'll like those too. And that's kind of how you learn. And it's kind of usually a lot more fun and a lot more organic to the person finding what they like.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break, Mark. When we get back, I want to get a little more into understanding regions and varietals and how we taste the nuances. But we're going to do that after a quick break. You're listening to the In Black and White's radio program on Voice America Business.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
ERISA 408B2, fiduciary standards, safe harbor, fidelity bonds, record keepers, discrimination testing. I am so confused.
Does your 401k plan have more questions than answers? Peter Weitz and his team of 401k experts have a solution. Their on-site service model distinguishes them from other service providers, and they are specialists in 401k costs, regulations, and compliance. If your 401k plan has more questions than answers, then contact Peter at 877-945-2888 or email him at peter@inblackandwhites.com.
Climbing Mount Everest is an amazing feat, and many have died trying to do so. However, more people have died descending Mount Everest than in reaching the summit. Part of the problem may be that people are so focused on reaching their objective that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will do or should be prepared for afterward. Similarly, people are so focused on saving for retirement and reaching retirement that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will encounter once they have actually retired. With one out of every four 65-year-olds today living past the age of 90, you may be retired longer than you are actually working. Have you devised a plan, process, and discipline to ensure that you will not run out of money? If you are not sure what to do, then simply contact Peter Weitz and his retirement team at Fusion Analytics. We help manage human emotions using three proprietary investment techniques. Our job is to evaluate the forces that the typical investor can't see so that wealth is preserved and not lost. Find out more at inblackandwhites.com. Weitz is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email Peter at inblackandwhites.com. In Black and Whites, we win by not losing.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to In Black and Whites. To reach Peter Weitz or his guest today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to peter@inblackandwhites.com. Weitz is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email peter@inblackandwhites.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Hi, thanks. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Peter Weitz. We're joined today by sommelier and certified specialist of wine and spirits, Mark Schlossberg. And prior to the break, we were talking about how he got involved in wine and, you know, how this industry has grown so tremendously. And I actually want to take a little bit of a different turn because this is the part that I don't understand. And talking with Mark over the break, I guess most Americans don't. But I'm just going to make a generic statement and say that I suck at geography. And with that in mind, I find it mind-numbing how I have to differentiate between all these different varietals from all over the world because I just don't know where any of them are, what that means in climate and mountains and soil and so forth. So, Mark, I mean, what's up with that? Why are we so bad at this?
I couldn't speak to the shortcomings of the American education system, but it seems like everybody I run into doesn't know anything really about geography. It's kind of a dry subject. I would say, to liven it up a little bit, it makes the understanding of wine much, much easier. One of the things about wine is that, I mean, it comes from grapes, and the whole point of the fruit is to nourish the seed and, you know, perpetuate the species or the plant. So, and how where the climate is or what the climate is that the grape is growing or the growing conditions dramatically affects the profile of the grape and its flavors and what grapes grow well where. For example, where it's really hot and sunny, the seed, even though it's inside the grape, is in danger of being sunburned. So grapes with a much thicker skin would protect the seed better, so they typically do well in much sunnier or much warmer or hotter climates. As a result, especially with red wine, the hotter and sunnier the place, typically the darker, the inkier the wine. Because all of that, as well as the tannins, by the way, typically come from the grape skin itself. And the thicker and more intense that skin, usually due to the sunlight and the heat, would then make the wine denser, darker, or tannic, and that sort of thing.
And Mark, just back with you, tell my listeners exactly what is a tannin and why is it important?
Well, tannin is the bitter flavors in wine. Tannin's an antioxidant. It's present in a lot of things, in tea. It's in the wood of the barrels. It's also in the skin of the grapes. It's that drying, bitter, astringent sensation that you get that along your gums that makes you that dries out your mouth and makes you make the fish face. You know, your cheeks pucker together inside in your mouth. It's a little different than acid. Some people have a little bit of difficulty differentiating the flavors. Acid does something similar, except it doesn't dry your mouth out. It makes your mouth water. And tannins would dry your mouth out. If you've ever had a cup of tea that you've steeped way too long and it's very intense, and that bitter, intense, drying sensation, those are tannins.
And obviously they're important to the wine.
Yeah, it's part of the blend of flavors. If it doesn't have, especially with red wine, if it doesn't have, like, say, some level of tannins, oftentimes the wine's going to be very soft, very juicy. It's going to be more like grape juice rather than something that lingers on your palate and cuts through the fat or the protein of a heavier meal.
Got it. So now, all right, so now we've, since I'm a failure at geography, walk me through some of the geography. I mean, let's go over into Europe and, you know, why are wines and grapes and France and Germany, why are they, you know, so robust?
Well, it would depend on where you're talking about. Like in Spain's southern Europe, and parts of Italy, southern Europe, it's going to be much hotter, and that's going to affect the grapes and the ripeness of the grapes, as well as the thickness of the skins. The other part of that is, as the grapes ripen, it converts the acid, the natural course of ripening, it converts the acids in the grapes to sugars. The colder climate wines tend to have a little more acid in the grapes. Warmer climate wines tend to have some more sugar in the grape. So then you get a little more alcohol and a little more of those sorts of flavors when it's a warmer climate. And you get a little more of the acid and fruit flavors when you get a cooler climate. So that's going to reflect, you know, the flavor profiles. Like in France, if you're getting wines from, say, the Rhone Valley, these bigger, darker sorts of wines, they're more intense because it's a much warmer place than, say, Burgundy. Burgundy is much cooler. So the red wines in Burgundy tend to be much lighter in color than the wines of the Rhone for a couple of reasons. One's the weather. And two is the kind of grape. The Rhone grapes tend to have a thicker, darker skin. The Pinot Noir that grows in Burgundy tends to be a very light skin.
And so let's just, you know, stay with France. I mean, obviously they've been producing wine for such a long period of time. What's going to differentiate a grape out of the Rhone Valley to make one better than another, other than the chemistry and the winemaker's sort of, you know, recipe? But short of that, I mean, what's going to differentiate a grape?
Well, the grape itself, the species of grape, well, they're all the same. Most of them are the same species, but they're all different varieties of grapes. And the ones that grow better in certain climates are the ones that make the best wines in those areas. Now, like in the New World, like, example, us in the United States, we've only been doing it for a few hundred years. So we try to borrow the knowledge from the other places where they've been doing it for thousands of years. They know in France that Pinot Noir grows best in Burgundy because they've tried lots of grapes and they've been doing it for over 1,000 years. And monks spent their entire lives over centuries studying this and recording it and figuring out what worked best. Now, what makes one Pinot Noir grape or one vineyard better than another vineyard in the same area? It's geography. It's location. Who gets more sunlight? Who gets better rainfall? Who has what kind of soil that provides what kind of nutrition for the grapes? Layers of soil are a lot like seasoning to a chef. As the vines, the roots grow down through the soil, they grow through different layers of types of soil, and they pick up different types of minerals and different types of nutrition, and that makes the flavor profile of the grape a lot more complex. So the older the vine and the types of the soil definitely aid in making a more complex or a more interesting flavored wine. That also would then increase the expense of a wine like that.
And you've introduced now yet another educational degree that I'd have to hold in agronomy on top of being a chemist and an expert in geography in order to be a wine expert.
Well, one of the things you could do would be have a person you could rely on at your local wine shop, or have a friend, you know, like everybody has a friend in their neighborhood who's handy and helps around the house. You could have a friend who's knowledgeable about wine and rely on that person. You know, everybody needs to know their butcher, their mechanic, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking about that, you know, and I'm going to use my father as an example. My father happens to love the Pinot Noir. And where is a good place for someone to begin if they've decided that that's the flavor that they like, where's a good place to begin determining the region, the price point, and so forth? How would they, you know, you mentioned the local wine store and your local wine merchant, but, you know, what would you be thinking about or what would you do to give advice to someone that happens to want Pinot Noir?
Well, the first thing I would say is if you think about what it is you like about the wine. So that way you could describe it to the person who's trying to assist you. And you don't have to be specific. You don't have to sound like a seasoned wine writer who's been doing it for 20 or 30 years. Something as simple as, I like the fruit flavor. Wines from New World places, basically not Europe, tend to have more fruit flavors. Wines from Europe tend to have more earth and mineral sort of flavors, and the fruit's a little more restrained. There's people who like both. There's people who prefer one or prefer the other. But being able to convey that information to the person trying to assist you would make their job and their effectiveness so much greater. And then they could say, well, if you don't really like the earth and mineral flavors, then let's stay out of Europe. Let's go with a California or a New Zealand or an Oregon Pinot Noir, and we'll talk about that and the fruit flavors there and what they like about that. If they really prefer the more earthy, mushroomy, animal sort of leather and those sorts of flavors, then they would talk about specific areas of Burgundy and what flavors those would provide.
And so with knowing that, then you all of a sudden you've narrowed Old World versus New World in the regions, and you can start focusing in on the Pinots that are going to appeal to you the most.
Exactly, exactly. When I was in the restaurant business and I would train waiters to help guide somebody through a very extensive wine list, there's two or three or four questions they could ask. The one person in the wine shop is going to do the same thing. Questions simply like, are you looking for a white or a red? You know, are you looking for something that's, you know, soft and fruity, or something that's more, complex and you know, a finer wine? And then what do you typically drink? Are you looking for things that are more fruit forward or things that are more mineral and earth forward? Do you want something that's simple and easy to understand because you're just going to drink it by the pool or on the boat? Or do you want something that's interesting and complex because you're going to savor it over an important dinner? And those few questions, if the person in the wine shop is aware of their, you know, inventory or skilled at their job, should have no trouble directing you to wines to choose from at a variety of price points.
And fruit forward, does that simply mean that's what you taste first?
Absolutely.
So when you sip the wine, the first thing you taste is that fruit?
Exactly.
Okay. And, you know, I guess the other question I hear is you hear this term, you know, this is a really big wine. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, everybody has their own idea of what that should mean. Typically in the wine business, when we talk about a big wine, we're talking about higher alcohol content. And then it could also include bigger, more intense tannins or bigger and broad flavors.
Right. So, I'm presuming that the higher alcohol means it's also going to be a little sweeter.
It could. It could. But it depends on also the balance of the wine. And that balance is always a tough concept for a lot of people. And I always try to explain it by using music as the analogy. If you're a person that likes, you know, classical music, it almost doesn't matter how loud the violin section plays as long as everybody else is playing at the appropriate volume level to make the music balanced. While everybody might be too loud, at least you'd be able to pick out every part of the music, whereas opposed one were overpowering the others. So it's the same sort of thing with a wine, or for that matter, any set of flavors in food or any beverage. You know, what is it well integrated? You could have a wine very high in alcohol and then be surprised by that because it marries so well with the other flavors and textures in the wine. Or sometimes you have a wine that's actually low in alcohol, but it's higher in alcohol than a wine of that profile should be, and it's overwhelming the flavor. You know, you get that burning sensation.
Right. And with that, when we get back, Mark, I'm going to put you on the spot and have you to give us some basics on how to really taste a wine. We're going to do that in just a moment. You're listening to the In Black and Whites radio program on Voice America Business.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Climbing Mount Everest is an amazing feat, and many have died trying to do so. However, more people have died descending Mount Everest than in reaching the summit. Part of the problem may be that people are so focused on reaching their objective that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will do or should be prepared for afterward. Similarly, people are so focused on saving for retirement and reaching retirement that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will encounter once they have actually retired. With one out of every four 65-year-olds today living past the age of 90, you may be retired longer than you are actually working. Have you devised a plan, process, and discipline to ensure that you will not run out of money? If you are not sure what to do, then simply contact Peter Weitz and his retirement team at Fusion Analytics. We help manage human emotions using three proprietary investment techniques. Our job is to evaluate the forces that the typical investor can't see so that wealth is preserved and not lost. Find out more at inblackandwhites.com. Weitz is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email Peter at inblackandwhites.com. In Black and Whites, we win by not losing.
ERISA 408B2, fiduciary standards, safe harbor, fidelity bonds, record keepers, discrimination testing. I am so confused.
Does your 401k plan have more questions than answers? Peter Weitz and his team of 401k experts have a solution. Their on-site service model distinguishes them from other service providers, and they are specialists in 401k costs, regulations, and compliance. If your 401k plan has more questions than answers, then contact Peter at 877-945-2888 or email him at peter@inblackandwhites.com.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are listening to In Black and Whites. To reach Peter Weitz or his guest today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to peter@inblackandwhites.com. Weitz is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email Peter at inblackandwhites.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Hi, thanks. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Peter Weitz. I'm joined today by Mark Schlossberg, a sommelier and certified specialist of wine and spirits. And we've been spending the whole program talking about the wine industry and, you know, its massive growth as a sector. And, you know, Mark, before the break, we were getting into some of the technical terms of tasting wine, and I want to get your little cheat sheet on what exactly we should be tasting. I'm going to do that in a second, but I also want to ask you sort of what's this I'm not a big cigar smoker, but there seems to be a really big connection between, you know, cigar aficionados and wine drinkers, and is that a good pair?
It can be. But not as often as most people think. A cigar is the tip. Let me go back. One of the things a sommelier has to learn about when they learn about all wine, it's not just wine, it's, you know, cheeses and chocolates and teas and other beverages, but it's also cigars, because it's anything that you would pair with a beverage, and those usually are paired with, to be honest, spirits, cognacs, brandies, you know, whiskeys, that sort of thing. There are, however, many, many fine wines that are big enough to stand up to a cigar, especially lighter cigars. The issue becomes with the smoke, it coats your palate and makes it difficult pick up on the nuances of the wine. But then again, not every wine is subtle nuances. Some are crafted to, or are just naturally that way, that they're crafted to pair better with cigars than others. In other words, I wouldn't have a very light glass of Pinot Grigio or Sauvignon Blanc with a very heavy, dark Maduro wrapper cigar. But there's no reason why you couldn't enjoy some good Spanish wines or some Italian wines or maybe even some Zinfandels out of California with a good cigar.
Interesting. So now let's get into, you know, what it is. And I've, you know, had the fortunate pleasure of sitting with you at several wine tastings. And I'm just fascinated by how you can just taste, you know, sample a wine and within a matter of a few seconds start to figure out where it's from, what the varietal is, and in the approximate year. And it actually led me to watch this documentary called Somme, which was focused on six students studying to be master sommeliers, of which, to my understanding, there's only a couple hundred in the world. And it's just amazing how you can train your palate to be able to discern all of this and focus onto just a specific bottle of wine.
Well, the people that become master sommeliers are not only extraordinarily dedicated, they're extraordinarily talented. And many, many people have tried and can't achieve that level of success or skill. There's only ever been about 220 master sommeliers in the world, and many of them have since passed. There's probably about 150 to 175 around. That documentary Somm is excellent, by the way. It almost turned it into a sporting event, and you know, with cheering and everything, and it was kind of interesting for those of us in the business. But in doing that, it's practice. You mentioned something about picking it up on the palate. What most people don't realize is it's more about the aromas than it is about the flavors. You really can only taste five things: salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and what the Japanese call umami. It's sort of a savory, proteiny sort of taste, and or some people call it the combination of the other four tastes. But you can smell, like I said earlier, 10,000 different things and train your brain to identify about 1,000 of them. How that practically works out for people is that, you know, if somebody says they can't taste anything because they have a cold, that's not entirely true. You would be able to tell if your chicken soup was too salty or too bitter. You just wouldn't be able to smell the nuances to know if they used rosemary or sage to season the chicken when they were cooking the soup. And that's kind of the difference. So as you become better at picking up on different aromas, then you become better at tasting wine. And it's just, like I said earlier, a set of deductive reasoning steps. Most people, when they're drinking wine or tasting wine, they're in a social setting, and it's hard to be objective and categorize things. And that's one of the things that you have to learn to, as a sommelier or as a wine buyer or a wine professional, is to be able to tune that out for a minute and objectively look at it and then, you know, remember it or take notes. I mean, I can objectively discuss whether a wine is well made. That's a completely other discussion as to whether or not I personally enjoy the wine.
Yeah, and I mean, I sit here and, you know, I go to these wine tastings and I take a sip and I, you know, try to do all this, you know, swirling the glass and so forth. But I take a sip, and if I like it, I like it. And if I don't, I don't. And
well, I was going to say, you're not in the wine business, so that's all you really need to know.
Right, right. And it's your job to actually find me the wine that I like.
Yes, me and many other people.
Right. So, all right. So let's just go through that a minute. So, I mean, someone pours me a glass of wine and I watch you, and the first thing you do is you tip the glass on its side and, you know, you put it up to a white piece of paper or something. You know, what are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at the wine itself. I'm looking to see if it's cloudy or clear. I'm looking to see how intense the color is, whether there's any sediment falling out of the wine. I'm looking to see if the color is consistent throughout, or what we would call a rim variation. And those are all giving me clues as to what is in my glass and what I should be expecting. And no, very rarely is there one simple thing that tells you what a wine is. They're usually, it could be this or it could be that, or it rules this out, but maybe these six other things are a possibility. And then you put all those bits of information together to come up with a conclusion. Now, I would say with practice, it happens rather quickly, in that documentary Somm you were talking about, when they take the Master Sommelier exam, they have to correctly identify six wines in 25 minutes. So they have 4 minutes and 6 seconds, or 4 minutes and 24 seconds or something like that per wine. And they have to tell you the region, the grape or grapes in the blend. They have to tell you the year within 2 years, and the relative quality of the wine as far as its producer, whether it's a, you know, village level table wine or if it's a high quality or Grand Cru or something like that.
And so you look at that, and then so let's just say, you know, what's cloudy versus clear going to tell you the difference?
Well, it might tell me there's something wrong with the wine. It might tell me it was either poorly filtered, if it's supposed to be a filtered wine, or it also might tell me that it was a more naturally produced, unfiltered, unfined wine, and I may be expecting some sediment. You know, some of the yeast may still be in there. There may be some different bits of the grape and different bits of the winemaking process, which definitely enhances the flavor, but may be off-putting to somebody depending on what they're looking for. So those are different things to look at. Then I would also look at the color intensity. The color intensity could tell me either where something about where it was grown, or it could tell me something about the grape varietal, or it could tell me something about the age of the wine. And all of those things would also kind of interrelate. Depending on the color of the wine, it could tell me that it was a cooler or hotter climate, and then it would help me also, based on the color, decide what grapes it may or may not be. But now we're talking about really inside baseball kind of stuff. Most people are just looking at it to see the color. If it's an intensely colored wine, or if it's a clear, if it's bright and crisp, you know, if it's shiny and shimmers and light, that usually tells you some things about the wine. And if you can say, hey, I like this wine, it was nice and shiny and bright, some of the other wines that are bright might have some similar taste characteristics. Doesn't always work that way, but it starts to help you find the things you like.
And if I say, could you make an argument or make it really simple and say that a lighter red is going to be indigenous to a certain type of varietal versus a darker red, which might be more like a Zin? I mean, is there a chart for that?
Yes, there absolutely is. Pinot Noir, especially from Burgundy, would tend to be one of your lighter color red grapes. And Zinfandels and Malbecs and Petit Syrahs could be some of your darkest skin grapes, so they would be some of your inkier and darker wines. Also, Malbec tends to grow in hot weather places in Argentina, so that would increase the intensity of the color. Zinfandel in hot weather places in like Lodi and places in California where it's a little bit hotter, so then the same kind of thing. And Pinot Noir in Burgundy tends to be a little bit cooler. Also, like in New Zealand, we also think we're mostly talking about Northern Hemisphere wines. There's also a lot of Southern Hemisphere wines. In New Zealand, Central Otago is like the southernmost wine-growing point in the world. It's very cool down there, and they do great, great Pinot Noirs and cold-weather grapes.
And now you've looked at the color. What's the next sort of step in figuring out?
Well, the whole visuals, then I would also swirl it and look to see the legs or tears on the sides of the glass. That might give me an indication as to alcohol. So, again, it would tell me whether, you know, something about the wine. Then I would start to smell it. I would swirl it and start to smell it and try to just observe what I'm getting. In other words, what do I smell first? Do I smell fruit or do I smell earth and minerals and that sort of thing first? If I smell fruit first, typically, not always, but typically it would be a New World wine. If I smell earth and minerals first, typically it would be an Old World wine. When I say Old World, I'm talking about primarily just Europe. That's going to give me an indication of where it came from and also might start to tell me something about the grape varietals. Then from there, I'll start, you know, picking apart what I smell. What fruits do I smell? What minerals do I smell? Do I smell any evidence that the wine was aged in wood? Like if I smell vanilla or spice or something like that, it would tell me it was in a new oak barrel. There are just different tricks that you pick up. Some people really like oaky Chardonnay, so you'd want something aged in a barrel. Some people don't like Chardonnay as oaky. They don't feel it goes with food as well, so they would pick an unoaked Chardonnay or one aged in what we call neutral oak. That's oak that's been used a few times, so it washes out some of the oak flavors.
Yeah, and then obviously there's many more steps, but I think, you know, sort of what I'm trying to draw here for the listeners, Mark, is, you know, what's sort of the simple way that I could walk through the tasting of a glass of wine to figure out what, you know, what really it is, I guess, because that really makes it more fun. But then also I help to narrow down what I enjoy drinking the most. And I want to talk a little bit more about sort of the fun side of this, and we're going to do that in just a minute, Mark. You're listening to the In Black and Whites radio program on Voice America Business.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
ERISA 408B2, fiduciary standards, safe harbor, fidelity bonds, record keepers, discrimination testing. I am so confused.
Does your 401k plan have more questions than answers? Peter Weitz and his team of 401k experts have a solution. Their on-site service model distinguishes them from other service providers, and they are specialists in 401k costs, regulations, and compliance. If your 401k plan has more questions than answers, then contact Peter at 877-945-2888 or email him at peter@inblackandwhites.com.
Climbing Mount Everest is an amazing feat, and many have died trying to do so. However, more people have died descending Mount Everest than in reaching the summit. Part of the problem may be that people are so focused on reaching their objective that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will do or should be prepared for afterward. Similarly, people are so focused on saving for retirement and reaching retirement that they fail to plan appropriately for what they will encounter once they have actually retired. With one out of every four 65-year-olds today living past the age of 90, you may be retired longer than you are actually working. Have you devised a plan, process, and discipline to ensure that you will not run out of money? If you are not sure what to do, then simply contact Peter Weitz and his retirement team at Fusion Analytics. We help manage human emotions using three proprietary investment techniques. Our job is to evaluate the forces that the typical investor can't see so that wealth is preserved and not lost. Find out more at inblackandwhites.com. Weitz is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email Peter at inblackandwhites.com. In Black and Whites, we win by not losing.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to In Black and Whites. To reach Peter Weitz or his guest today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to peter at inblackandwhites.com. Whites is spelled W-E-I-T-Z. Email peter at inblackandwhites.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Hi, right, thanks. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Peter Weitz. I'm joined today by sommelier and wine expert Mark Schlossberg, and we've been discussing, you know, the nuances of this industry and how to taste wine. And, you know, Mark, at the break, I actually thought of a couple of questions, and, you know, I just wanted to run them by you. The first is this. I was posed this question last week, which is, what does the wine rating scale mean to you? And to me personally, all it means is a place to start. You know, if something gets 90 points or 92 points, it's going to pique my interest, but it's not necessarily going to make me buy the wine, but I guess it's going to help me narrow it down. What's the wine scale mean to you?
Well, it means a lot of things. One, if I'm talking about a wine and if I'm going to the points that some other person gave it, then it means personally I have very little to say about the wine or I don't know much about it. Because like you said, that's a starting off point. For a lot of people, it is. From my point of view, I think the starting off point should be somebody that you know or somebody who can tell you what they've tasted or their experience. Because just because an expert gave it a scale or a rating on a scale, they may be telling you it's technically a very well-made wine, which can be an objective sort of rating. Whether or not you like it or whether or not it's going to meet the requirements of the occasion for which you're opening the wine, that's an entirely subjective thing. And without understanding your tastes relative to the reviewers, sometimes that can be a little misleading. And what I would say to that is simply this. Most wines are going to get a pretty good score. Most wines are relatively well made these days. The wineries are clean. The technology and the skill of the winery and the winemakers do relatively a pretty good job. Everything should be getting, or most things are getting, you know, in the 80s, high 70s, 80s. They're drinkable wines. Now, the subtle differences between what gives a wine an 89 versus a 90 versus a 91 could dramatically affect the selling price because it's like a score. And Americans feel that way about wine or about everything. We all remember when we were in school and got a 90 on a quiz, and that was way better than an 89. And we kind of think that way about all sorts of scoring systems. I would suggest read what it says. Because if, as you start to cultivate a love for wine, I personally, more often than not, would pick a wine that is really interesting and has flavors and textures that I like, even if it might have a minor flaw or might have some things that are technically wrong with it, rather than a technically perfect wine that was industrially made and kind of has no soul. I'm kind of allowing for the art and the beauty in the wine. And the differences, you know, that artist might not have made great brushstrokes compared to a technically skilled painter, but that doesn't mean the painting isn't amazing.
Yeah, and you know that makes me think of something. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, my business practice is in retirement planning and in 401k plans. But you know, when I think about retirement plans, there's certain things that are not allowed in IRAs. One of them is art, one of them is gold, and one of them is wine. And I guess the question is number one, how long can you keep a wine? And who decides, or what market decides what it's actually worth?
Well, as with anything on a secondary market, it's worth what somebody's willing to pay for it. A lot of that earlier goes. We talked about going to its prestige, its scarcity, and those sorts of things. Some wines are made and are acknowledged over time to hold up for long periods of time. You know, some of the great Bordeaux that people talk about, you know, the 1947 Cheval Blanc people talk about as possibly one of the best wines ever made. In the movie Sideways, the character Miles holds up a 1961 Cheval Blanc as what was the gem of his collection. Some people think the 61 Latour or the 29 Latour were the greatest and those sorts of things. And at some point it becomes the prestige, it becomes the ego that I'm the only one that has this in my collection. But at that point then are you going to open the wine or are you going to hold it as an investment?
And that's my question. That's my next question, Mark. Yeah. I happen to have a very high-end collectible bottle of wine. And my argument is, do I drink it or do I hold it? And how long do I hold it for?
Well, again, without getting into the specifics of each wine, it would depend on the wine itself. Now, when you read a review on a wine and they say, the reviewer says something like, this wine would be best from, you know, 2016 to 2027, that's their estimate. Hopefully they're skilled, they have an idea of what's going on. And as a wine ages, there are certain things in a wine that are preservatives naturally in wine. Alcohol is one. Tannin is one, acid, sugar can be one. It just depends on the makeup of the wine itself. And some wines, based on the grape from which it was made, the area in which it was grown, lend itself to having higher quantities of those items, antioxidants, so forth, that would lead the wine to age longer over time. High alcohol is one of those things. So when we talk about fortified wines, you know, port, Madeira, sherry, that sort of thing, the alcohol is going to definitely help preserve the wine and keep it for extended periods of time. Some wines aren't really drinkable young. I mean, if you bet a vintage port, while it's bottled and sold in the first few years after it's been made, you really don't want to drink it for somewhere between 15 and 30 years to get it at its best. And really good ones go 50, 60 years easy.
Yeah,
but when it comes to a high-end bottle of wine, it's just a question of how much is it worth to you? Is the experience of having it worth more than the ability to talk about the fact that you bought it at one price and sold it at another price? I mean, there's a lot of different things you get from that wine. And then if it's really expensive, it could be a life-changing economic thing. So then you want to then decide if you want to drink it or want to sell it.
Yeah, right, because my thought is I take a really big bottle of wine, expensive bottle of wine, sell it, and start buying a handful of less expensive-priced wines and build a collection.
That's a strategy. That's a strategy. I know in some of the wines in my collection, I've got them sectioned off for different occasions. I mean, we talk about, you know, special occasion wines. And, you know, am I opening this bottle of wine just because it's a Tuesday evening and I feel like having a glass of wine? Am I opening this bottle of wine because I have some friends over and we're cooking dinner? Am I opening this bottle of wine because, you know, these are friends that I haven't seen in 20 years and that I grew up with and it's a real special occasion? Is it my 25th wedding anniversary? And you talk about the different occasions that you're opening these amazing bottles of wine. Well, I would say that, you know, the wine itself could be the occasion or the wine's only complementing the occasion. But what I would caution people against is saving that incredible bottle of wine and sharing it with people who don't get how much passion you have for it. Because you never want to have the experience of opening that bottle of 61 Latour and having Aunt Margaret put ice and club soda in it and have it break your heart. Of course,
right,
if you have a glass of wine, she's entitled to drink it how she enjoys.
Right. Right, that totally makes sense. And Mark, I appreciate all those comments. Obviously, wine is so it's a lot of fun, but very complicated. I think because it's just so there's so many nuances associated to it. But you know, I think it'd be pretty cool, and I'm going to lean on you that we should develop a little wine tasting for dummies, for lack of a better term. I'll post it up on my blog, but we'll give a little cheat sheet to those listeners out there that are really interested in it so they could figure out the simplest and most fun way to be able to discern what an actual wine is and what they're tasting.
Sure, we can do that. And one suggestion I would make, if there's time, is that to enjoy wine with friends, maybe decide what you're going to make for dinner and invite a few couples over and suggest what they bring as a wine. Have one person bring a Chardonnay from France, one from California, and one from New Zealand, and then taste them together and see what the differences are, but in the same grape from different places. Or maybe pick wines from different grapes from the same place and kind of explore wine with your friends that way. That way everybody has different opinions and you can taste more a bit greater variety of wines without having to spend a ton of money figuring out what you like.
Yeah, and that's great advice. And Mark, with that, I really appreciate you being on today's program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and again, anybody has any questions, I can make sure you email me, Peter at inblackandwhites.com, or my hit me up on Twitter or LinkedIn. LinkedIn is at Peter Whites. And if you have any questions for Mark, I'll be happy to pass them along. Thanks for listening, Mark. Thanks for being on the program. Make it a great week. And you're listening to the In Black and Whites radio program on Voice America Business.
Thank you again for tuning in to In Black and Whites. Please join your host, Peter Whites, again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 a.m. Pacific Time for another edition of the program on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a safe week.